My name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. And first of all, before I start, I'd definitely like to thank the committee for inviting me to come down. It's you guys have really done an awesome job. And I really appreciate this being invited. Chapter 5 tells me what I'm supposed to do. I will tell you in a general way what I was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in a very blue-collar, very ethnic neighborhood, like Mickey said, member of the CIA, Catholic-Irish alcoholic, I tell you, with a short walk from my house, there were 5 Catholic churches, and there was a tap room on every corner, and there was no booze at all in my house growing up. My father did not drink. My mother could not drink. My mother suffered from a history of mental illness and abused prescription medication, so we had no booze at all in the house. But my grandparents lived around the corner from us, and that's where I had my very first drink. And I forget how old I was, but I was very young, and I remember it was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because I remember going to Connie Mack Stadium with my father. Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies, and he had the old schoolboy in right center field. And I forget what party we had, but it was all the christenings and everything was held at my grandparents' house. They had a little bar in the basement, and I was running around and polishing off the half empties or the half fulls. And the people, my uncles and whatnot, they all thought it was cute. They say, look at Bobby drinking, And I felt a part of. I mean, I didn't get drunk. I was just a kid, but I felt a part of. And that's what I liked. I always wanted to be a part of. I never felt a part of. It's crazy because, I'm 1 of 8, and like we're all like within a year apart, and there's no twins in my family. So my mom was pregnant like for almost 9 years. And there was 10 of us who lived in a small 3-bedroom row home and, on top of each other. And I never felt a part of, and I always wanted to be a part of. And that would even be true when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I always wanted to be a part of. My drinking really took off in high school. Most of the kids in my neighborhood went to the diocese in high school. But my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school that wasn't far from my home. And I felt kind of, I didn't feel part of there because most of the kids that went there were from affluent families from the suburbs. And it was me and a couple other dirtballs in the neighborhood. We went there. And we used to walk to school. And right away we had some sort of reputation. A lot of these kids, it was their first introduction to the inner city. So as their parents were dropping them off at the school in their luxury automobiles, me and the guys were inside robbing their lockers. And I knew that was wrong. But I did that anyway. And you know what? I did a lot of things that I knew was wrong. Like, I had the training. I knew the difference. But I wanted to be part of. I had a lot of nicknames, and one of those nicknames was Crazy Coyle. I would do certain things because it came, you expected it of me. And even though I felt uncomfortable doing it, I would have felt more uncomfortable if you didn't accept me. So I did a lot of crazy things. I was at the prep, about 2 or 3 weeks. It was football season, and there was a road trip, and there was a bus, and there was beer, and there was police, and it just got nuts. And I remember when I came back to school on Monday, the disciplinarian, he had us lined up. There were 7 of us. And it was me and another kid from the neighborhood, 2 freshmen, and everyone else was upperclassmen. He came right to the other kid and me from the neighborhood. He came up to us. He said, what's with you guys? You're here 2 weeks, and you get caught up in this nonsense. And I just shrugged my shoulders. Father, just happened, one of those things. And that's the type of guy that I was. I saw that guy just like me, even though I was only in this situation for 2 weeks. But I'm right away, I'm figuring out who's about what. And these are the type of guys I want to hang out with. When it came, my sophomore year, I was there was a bar a couple blocks away called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And when I was a sophomore, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple different reasons. They had dancers, they had cold beer. But a lot of times, because of the neighborhood where the school was, it was a pretty rough area. And a lot of these kids, like I said, it was their first introduction to the inner city. So they used to catch the trolley from 18th Street to Broad Street, which is only 4 blocks, and then catch the subway. Like, they were scared to walk those 4 blocks. But because we had this reputation of walking the schools, I would used to stroll out Gerard Avenue instead of the Ebony. And I can now tell you, every time I strolled out Gerard Avenue or sat in the Ebony, I was terrified, but I didn't want anybody to know. Again, I needed to show off to people. But I was a regular at the Ebony, and it was amazing, because I'm just a little peach fuzz kid, little tiny kid, suit and tie, a shirt and blazer. They knew that I was only about 15, but they served me anyway. And I liked the attention that came with that. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I had no desire to further my education, and it kind of took my parents off, because they really sacrificed to send me there. So I knew I couldn't stay home, because there'd be hell to catch, and I really didn't have any other options, so the only thing left was the service, and I enlisted in the service. And that really wasn't a bright move, because back then nobody else was going. And I enlisted, and I got sent overseas, and I spent 13 months overseas, and that's when my drinking really took off. Now, I didn't mess around with other substances because I knew a lot of good guys from my neighborhood who had gone over and got whacked on certain things. So I didn't mess around with any of that stuff, but I was definitely drunk at this time. I was there a couple months and several good friends of mine were killed, and I didn't know how to handle that, you know. The way we grew up, we didn't tell anybody nothing, you know. And once you moved out of the house, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the house. Everything stayed inside and everything stayed within the walls of the house. And that's just the way it was. It's not a shot at anybody, but that's just the way it was. Whenever we talked, everything was all surface stuff. So when this incident happened, with my friends getting killed, I didn't know how to handle it. But I knew that booze was a good escape and it numbed the pain, and that's what I did, you know. And I just drank. I didn't distinguish myself either over there, but I didn't do Bailey either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by, and that would set the tone for the next few years. When my tour was up, I came back home and I started going to school. I went to St. Joe's College, and I remember one day it was a mid like spring day, and the Phillies there was an afternoon game, one of those businessman specials, like a Thursday 12:30 afternoon game, and a couple guys in the neighborhood had called me the night before and said, "Bobby, we'll go to Phillies tomorrow." So I cut class and we went down to the Phillies game. And I'm sitting up on the 700 level, the top of the stadium, and the sun's beating down. I'm drinking that cheap watered down beer, and I'm getting trashed. And I told the guys I was with, I said, "You know what, I'm going to run down on the field and meet one of the players." And they kind of shrugged me off because another one of my nicknames was Bullshit Bob. I used to tell these stories, "I'm going to do this, I did that." You know, I didn't do nothing. I drank, that's all I did. So I had worked my way down to the old picnic area there. I jumped over the fence and I ran out in right field, and the San Diego Padres were in town and Dave Winfield was playing right field for the Padres. And I went out and shook his hand. I said, "Hi, Dave, how you doing?" And he looked at me. He said, "Brother," he said, "what are you doing out here?" And from behind him, I saw the guards coming. I said, "Dave, I got to go now." So I start running towards the infield. I went to slide into second base. And as I was running towards the infield, there was more guards coming from the third base side. So if I slid into the base, I'd get caught. So I turned around and started walking to the first base side. And I'm as close to the guard like as Jennifer and I are right now. I'm walking like I give myself up. And the last second, I deked the guy and I ran out in the outfield. I'm running around like a lunatic, I think like 10 minutes, but it's probably more like 3 and 4. And they put up on the scoreboard, "Mr. Excitement." I finally gave up in right field. And as they was taking me off the field, I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. It was amazing. Tug McGraw was in the bullpen and he gave me the thumbs up, like, "Way to go." Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from the guards. I figured that was coming with the territory, but that was okay for me because of all this attention I just got. I knew I would be a legend back in the neighborhood for about 15 minutes, but I could take the beating. But just then, a Philadelphia police lieutenant came up to me. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Are you drunk? Are you high?" I said, "No, I'm just happy. Just happy to be here." He said, "Well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium." So he saved me from a beating, but most of all, he saved me from getting arrested. Because when I was in St. Joe's, I took several civil service tests, and one of the tests I took was for the city, and 3 weeks later, I got hired by the police department. It's amazing. I spent most of my time up in North Philly. North Philly's a pretty rough area of town, and I saw the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of my tour, I would go out and drink, you know, with the guys on the squad, and I wasn't even old enough to drink. Pennsylvania, the drinking age was 21, and at that time, the drinking age over in Jersey was 18. And where I lived, I can get over Jersey quicker than other parts of Philadelphia, so we used to go over Jersey a lot to our drinking. But once I came on the job, you know, we had a guy, our mayor was a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo, and there was 8,500 of us at this time, and we did whatever we wanted to do. We had to run in the city, and my badge got me in a lot of doors, and it allowed me to drink, and allowed me to do a lot of behaviors, get away with a lot of behaviors. But there were things in the job that I saw that bothered me, and I wanted to tell my coworkers, but they're part of me, I couldn't tell them because I didn't want to be thought less than. You know, I wanted to be part of the guys. And I would even get involved in behaviors that I was uncomfortable with, and I knew my gut was wrong, but I did it anyway, you know. And I did pretty good in the job, and drinking, I was drinking a lot. And the writing was on the wall. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous at a young age. I made my very first meeting in 1979. And the way that happened, our job, we had an EAP unit, and part of that EAP unit also had AA meetings. And the name of the group was called 369. And I remembered I showed up at work one day, and my supervisor, like my coworker, showed up drunk, and my supervisor said, "Take this guy up to the unit." So I'm driving my partner up to the unit, and I'm coming down the driveway, 369, and there was a guy sitting on the porch. His name was Eddie M. And I said, "Eddie, I'm dropping this guy off. I'll be, I'll be back at 4 o'clock to pick him up." Eddie looked me dead in the eye. He said, "Hey, kid, do you want to come in?" I said, "No. I was insulted that he even asked me. I know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. AA was for you older guys. you married guys, you guys at the Three Heads, I didn't have a problem. I was a beer drinker. The only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Paddy's Day or like New Year's Day or payday, but I was a beer drinker. An alcoholic was those poor souls I was dealing with day in, day out. I certainly wasn't a drunk. And it's funny because I got sober a few years later and Eddie was one of the first guys I saw, so he nodded. He said, "So kid, you finally came around." It just goes to show you every drink was necessary to came with that. I was 24 years old. I shot and killed a 15-year-old kid. I killed a kid, 15 years old, in the line of duty, and it was a terrible situation. It was one that couldn't have been avoided, and I used it as an excuse to crawl in the bottle for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27, and there was a lot of help offered to me, and I rejected everybody. I just wallowed in self-pity, and I said, "You guys don't understand." And because of this incident, you know, I wound up getting transferred and then promoted, and so my coworkers, because of this, you know, I got a lot of slack, and what they did, they carried me for a couple of years, and I just went off. My drinking took me into a lot of my nevers, and one of those nevers is the use of other substances. I said I would never mess around. I never mess around. One night when I was drunk, I got involved in other substances. My drug history is very short. It only lasted 17 months, and I think out of the fifth tradition, I think that's all I need to say about that stuff. I was just a terrible human being. If I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused like everyone I came in contact with. You know, going back to like that running around on the field, the reason I tell that story, it's the only funny story I got. I'm not a funny guy. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a lover. I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent drunk. You know, and like I said, I used and abused everybody I came in contact with. Another thing was, I was a major blackout drinker. There's a lot of things I don't remember. And I would remember when I show up to work the next day, like the guys would just shake their heads. "Oh, Bobby, you was nuts last night." I liked that. I liked the attention I got from the older guys, but I had no clue what the hell they was talking about, you know? And those 3 years, from 24 to 27, it was just a mess, you know? It was a mess. I was sitting home one day, and I was reading the Daily News, and there was an ad in the paper that said, "Alcohol problems, drug problems, marital problems, depression, thoughts of suicide." I was 4 out of 5. I was single, and I'm sure if I was married, I'd have been batting 1,000. And I took a look at the ad, and they talk about the moment of clarity or sanity. As soon as it came, it left. You know, I looked at it and maybe, and said, "Nah, not me." And I continued on drinking and doing my other things. But something made me cut that ad out, and I stuck it in my wallet. It was, you know, and like I said, the writing was on the wall. I had a supervisor pull me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid, you're smart, and you're going to go places. That booze is going to mess you up." I was sober 3 years. I run into this guy in a meeting. He's sober a lot of years. And I realized at that point that he was trying to 12-step me. You know, I had an uncle on the job who was a boss on the job, and he pulled me off to the side. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing a lot of stories about you. That booze is going to get you in trouble." I was sober 2 years. I ran into my uncle. My uncle was sober 15 years. Talk about the secrets in the family. And here he is sober, and the family don't want to talk about that. Sober 2 years. I ran into my uncle. He's 15 years sober. And I said, "Uncle Jim," I said, "how come you didn't tell me?" He said, "I told you." He said, "You just weren't ready yet." I realized at that point that he was trying to 12-step me, you know. I just wasn't ready. And everything that went with that drink, I guess, was necessary for me to drive me to my knees because I wasn't willing to listen. And I'm a pretty bright guy, and I can intellectualize anything and, you know, cover the angles, but, you know, this is one battle I was definitely losing. When I was sitting in the bar, it was Memorial Day, I'm sitting in the bar, and the guys on the squad, and we had a party, and one of the guys I was with decided to drive home. And I told him, I said, "I'll tell you what," I said, "you know, you're pretty drunk." I said, "How about if I drive you home?" I wasn't as drunk as he was. And this is before they coined the phrase designated driver. So he got in my car, and I was driving out Poplar Street, and there was a kid riding towards me on a bicycle. And I decided I was going to show off in front of my partner. I was going to show off my driving skills, and I decided I was going to play chicken with this kid. And unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction. I ran this kid over. As he lied bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car with my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me for an insurance claim. My partner prevented me from doing this. I pulled this kid off the hood of my car and threw him off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car and threw that off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar and I said I scored 10 points and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep. I was just a nasty person. And I didn't know what to do, you know. So what I did, I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, and some other substances, and I checked in a hotel with the intention of consuming all this stuff to build up the courage and my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the hotel door to kick me out. And I couldn't shoot myself because at this point I was suspended from my job. I no longer had access to my weapon. So I walked over to the window and I opened up the window and I was going to jump out. And when I opened up the window, I was on the fifth floor and I remembered I was scared of heights and I wanted to jump. So I go in the bathroom and I filled the bathtub up with water and I had a blow dryer and I was going to pull the blow dryer in the tub to make it appear to accidental electrocution. But every time I would pull the blow dryer, it would come unplugged. That's about a foot and a half turn and turn. So I got 1 foot in the tub and I'm leaning trying to plug it in. You know, it seemed like a scene out of a Woody Allen movie. You know, like I couldn't even kill myself. So I laughed too, but you know what? I never ever want to forget the pain I was in that day. As the last I had a drink, and what I did, my only tool I had was my car. So I took one last spin through the neighborhood. I started up at the Falls Bridge and I came down the East River Drive, driving towards the Art Museum, and I decided I was going to end my life in an automobile accident. And I at first thought that I wanted to go oncoming traffic, but I realized I didn't want to hurt anybody innocently, you know. I got tired of hurting people, and like I said, I hurt everybody. If I came in contact with you, you got hurt one way or the other. And so I decided to wrap myself around a tree. And for those, you know, not familiar, the East River Drive is a very winding road along the Schuylkill River, and I'm surprised that I didn't go in an accident by accident because I had no control. You know, I just start crying. And I finally pulled over at the end of the East River Drive at the last boathouse, and it's no longer there. And I pulled over and I stepped behind the wheel of my car and I cried like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached into my wallet, and there was that ad that I clipped out of Down Newell Street about 6 weeks before. And I called that phone number up and I spoke to that woman like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. You know, I lied to everybody. I told so many stories, I believed them. I didn't know the difference between reality and fantasy. But I told her everything. I figured she didn't know me from a can of paint. What did I have to lose? I could always hang up. But once I started, I couldn't stop. It just came pouring out. And I told her everything. And she had a coworker working behind the scenes. And she said, when I got done talking, she said, I tell you what. She said, drive over to the Hahnemann Hospital. They'll be waiting for you. So I drove over to the Hahnemann Hospital. They're waiting for me. And they admitted me to the 10th floor of the psychiatric unit. And I spent about 3 or 4 days there. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philly. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville. And I spent about 3 weeks in their flight deck before they put me in an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I did not believe I had a problem with alcohol. I thought it was my short use of other substances. I thought maybe I was mentally ill and I had inherited that from my mother. You know, maybe I'd suffered post-traumatic stress. Maybe the fact that I was a mummer. It was this, it was that, it was the neighborhood I lived in. It was everything. It was nuts. Certainly wasn't the booze. And I remember when I got into the alcohol and drug ward at the VA hospital, they had in the day room, up on the wall, they had the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I go up to the steps and I zip through them. I get about 4 or 5 of them done. I saw the amends. I said, just screw it. I don't need to do that. I was nuts. But what happened was, in my very first day there, somebody came up from the outside and had a meeting that night. I would later find out that was the institution committee on a 12-step call. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background, about his experience that I couldn't relate to, couldn't identify with, or just didn't like, I would immediately tune him out. See, I was too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. But what offended me the most was at the end of the meeting, everyone held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people are about, then I don't want nothing to do with you. I talk about my mom's mental illness. My mom was a fundamentalist at the church, you know, with the candles and the radio programs and pictures and all that other stuff. I came home from school. I was 15 years old. I found my mother. My mother had split her wrist. And I'm in the house for about 10 minutes before I come across her. And I remember when I walked in her room, I found her. She looked up at me. She said, Bobby, help me. And I looked down at her and said, good for you. And I walked out of the house. And I remember I got an older guy to get me a quart of wine from the state store, and I stayed out and I drank the wine. And I stayed out long enough so my father, he came home later, he found her. And when I came home later that night, my dad had told me what happened. I acted surprised. I said, oh yeah, how about that? That happened when I was 15. I think it's over, I was 27, so it's 12 years of carrying that resentment around. And I wouldn't get involved in the steps for another couple of years. I don't want nothing to do with you people. You know, I don't want nothing to do with God, nothing at all. And I broke away from the circle and refused to participate in the prayer. When I finally got released from the VA hospital, the best advice they ever gave me, a nurse pulled me off to the side. I would later find out that she was a member of the fellowship. She said, I strongly suggest you go to AA meetings. And I need to let you know now, that's where I got my recovery. I got my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, not at the VA hospital. The VA hospital helped me a lot with a lot of different things. But the best piece of advice they gave me, they said, go to AA meetings. And I went to AA meetings every single day. and I came late and I left early. I don't drink coffee, so I don't make it. I don't smoke cigarettes, so I don't empty ashtrays. I walked into a big book meeting or step meeting that was strictly by accident. I would leave at halftime. I had something better to do. I didn't take your phone numbers. I didn't like you. Most of you people were screwballs anyway. And they held hands where I went to meetings, and I wasn't part of holding hands either. And it was just nuts. But I made meetings. And most of all, and the reason I kept coming back, because you said, keep coming back. And that pissed me off so bad. I said, you know what, all right, I'll come back. I'll show you. And I came back. For no other reason, just to show you, I was angry. I was nuts. I would share these little witty stories from the table and then go to the men's room or go get a cup of tea and come back. The seat next to me would be empty. People was nuts. I was sober, maybe 8-9 months now. And I'm sitting in this bar because they sell real good roast beef. And I'm drinking seltzer in a mug. And you know what? I can give you any number of reasons, but I now know the truth was I want to show off to the guys in the neighborhood. You know, because, you know, my drinking escapades caused me some problems on my job, and I got knocked down a couple pegs. You know, for a while there, I thought I was prince of the city, and I managed to alienate a lot of people because I can be real nitwit sometimes. And so other people took glory, I guess, in my demise. And So I want to go back to the bar to let these guys know, you know what, I am back and things are going good, and you know, and but I'm drinking seltzer. Some guys in the bar that I knew from my neighborhood came in, and one thing led to another, words got exchanged, and I stood up and I punched a guy in the face with the mug. And I cut him pretty severely, and the police came, and the guys who handled the job, they knew me, and they cut me a break, and they let me go. And that's where I learned my lesson about people, places, and things. And I haven't been in a place like that since. I found a place that sells real good roast beef without serving any booze. You know, and that's just a lesson I learned. I was sober just under a year, and all the men in the group were going on a retreat. And I wanted to be accepted by these guys so much. And I hated them all. But I wanted them. But I got so mad because they never asked me to go out afterwards. And I wanted to go out with them so much, but I hated them. And so they came up to me and said, listen, we're going on this retreat. Are you going to go on this retreat? I never told anybody a story about my mom. And I really didn't want to go, but the part of me that needed to be accepted outweighed everything else. And I said, okay, I'll go. And I remember driving, you know, going up to this retreat, and my stomach was in knots because I had no idea what I was getting into, and I really didn't want nothing to do with this. And I don't know why they asked me anyway, probably because they got tired of me not joining the circle, saying the prayer at the end of the meeting. So I'm at the retreat. I'm there about 15 minutes, and I run into the retreat master, right? He's my disciplinarian from high school. He also happened to be a long-time member of AA. As soon as he saw me, his eyes lit up. He said, wow. He said, so that was your problem, huh? So he started talking to me. He said, listen, he said, you got yourself, you know, he said, how long are you sober? I'm telling him, you know, I'm coming up on a year and all this other stuff. He said, great. He said, you got a sponsor? I said, no, I ain't got a sponsor. He said, I'm a bright guy. I don't need a sponsor, you know. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. So, all right, I'll get one. So I asked my roommate to be my sponsor. And the only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. And every time I would bump into him, he would say, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him. In fact, you know what? I used to talk bad about this guy. I used to make stories of, oh, he did this, he did this. He didn't do nothing. He put the hand of help out there, and I'm the one who slapped it away and character assassinated this guy. The guy gave him himself. I rejected it. I was sober a year, and I told my story. And in this particular group, you had to identify yourself as an alcoholic, and that was it. And so I did, and I didn't believe it. I really did not believe I was an alcoholic. I thought it was my short use of other substances. Maybe I was mentally ill, and I got that from my mom. I had distress from the service, from the job. You know, it was nuts, but I certainly didn't have a problem with booze. I was a beer drinker. But I told the group I was an alcoholic. And during my story, like, I wowed them, you know. I gave them all the quotes and the literature. I gave them everything they wanted to hear. And when I got done speaking, they came up and they patted me on the back and said, way to go, Bobby, you're doing so good. I lied on the entire story. I told them all lies. In fact, when I was telling my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. I couldn't tell you guys that. You wanted to hear the quotes out of literature. That's what I gave you, you know. It was, you know, it was nuts. I was sober 23 months, and I beat another man with a baseball bat. I forget what step I was working that day. But I was nuts. You know, it was nuts. I swear, it was nuts. I was crazy. I made meetings every single day in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was dying from untreated alcoholism. I would tell these stories, and people say, that's okay, Bobby, just don't drink. I used to do this. I used to go to, I'll tell you. I used to go to bars where they had dancers, and I used to get my picture taken with dancers, and then I would go to the meetings and pass them around to the old-timers. Because I really wanted to be accepted by these guys. And I'm sober like a year and a half. And they just look at the pictures, they look at me, and they just shake their head, and they said, keep coming back. And I would just get madder. I got mad. I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering why everybody was blowing this guy's anonymity. I said, you know, I said, he's really a tough SOB. I wouldn't want to tangle with him. When I found out what John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid. But I'm here, I am so damn bright, I'm going to figure out this program, and I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. It was nuts. Crazy. In my home, in my group, we used to put like the anniversaries for the month, you know, and they have your name and, you know, your years. I used to take pleasure when people went out. You know, like you know, I'm coming up on 2 years and you got 3 years and you go out. So, whoa, there you go. I used to move up. That's how nuts I was. I was crazy. Yeah, especially if they came back. Then I would really sad. Yeah, keep coming back. I was nuts. I made meetings every single day in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a liar, thief, and a cheat. I 13-step people. I did everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't pick up a drink. And people said, that's okay, just don't drink. I took that. I said, well, I can do whatever the hell I want to do, and I just don't drink. I now know that's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. People say, just don't drink no matter what. Just don't drink and go to a meeting. Well, if I could just not drink, why do I need to go to a meeting? How come I can't stay home? They say, just don't drink no matter what. Well, you know what? I drank no matter what. When I had my job and making overtime and all that money, I drank. And you know what? When I was suspended and broke, I drank because I stole your money. And when I had a girlfriend, I drank. And when she left me, I drank. You know, I drank 4th of July, St. Patty's Day, October 3rd. It didn't matter. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 o'clock in the, you know. I would stop a lot of times. I would try to give it up for Lent. I never made it. I would always get loaded. I would give it up because my job, I was threatened with suspension because I was abusing my sick time. I would go on the wagon for a bit, and you know what? I would drink again. I would live with people, and they would say, Bobby, you're a pretty decent human being, but when you drink, you become a pig and an animal. If you continue on acting that way, I'm going to leave you. And I loved them, and I drank. You know, I would be good for a while. I tried to stop. I'd stop drinking many, many times. I can never stop drinking, you know. I always start drinking again. So when people say, just don't drink no matter what, that's, you know, especially for those who are new, that's a lie. That's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, to be honest, that's a direct contradiction to the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable. If people say, just don't drink no matter what, that implies willpower. I myself have no willpower whatsoever over alcohol. Here I was making meetings every single day in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to kill myself. My second anniversary came. I didn't celebrate it. 25 months. 1 month after my second anniversary, I had my revolver back in my mouth. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, but 25 months before, I was loaded with alcohol and drugs. Here I am making meetings every single day. Want to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. And I knew that there was a better way of life. But I refused to get involved in it. People doing the right thing, I used to talk bad about them. The fact was they intimidated me. They scared the hell out of me. They had this peace of mind. You know, they say you can't miss what you never had. I never had a peace of mind. I never missed it. When I was around calm people, I would have to stir it up to get it goofy. I was comfortable goofy. Calm scared the hell out of me. I went to eat my gun. And I'm in a meeting one day, and it was a pathetic feeling. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to die. I wanted to die. I wanted to drink. I was just nuts. And there was a guy from the neighborhood I saw in a meeting, and this guy was the original jitterbug. He was in and out of Greaterford, which is a state prison in Pennsylvania in the late 60s, early 70s, like a revolving door. In fact, he wound up killing someone. He went to jail, and he got out. And I knew this guy was for real. He was sober a number of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew he was for real because it wasn't in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in the neighborhood where I saw him. For me, it's real easy to stay sober in a meeting. Our meetings back home are an hour and a half. But what about the other 22 and a half hours? The time on my job, the time with my family, the time in the neighborhood where it's tough to stay sober. And I saw this guy in the neighborhood. I knew that he was for real. He had this glow about him. Like, I could fake the talk, you know, because I'm on the ball and I can let you know, quote literature and things like that. But that's talking the talk. This guy was walking the walk, and he had that glow, and you couldn't fake the glow. And I asked him one night, I said, you know, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? He looked me dead in the eye. I said, okay, I'll be your sponsor. But he said, you know what, Bobby, I've been watching you. And I'm sticking my chest out. I said, cool, he likes me. He said, you know what? He said, you're full of shit. And I looked at him, I can't believe you said that to me. You know, and he said, I want to be your sponsor under certain conditions. He said, hey, you're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to one big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting a week. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment, and you're going to leave them damn women alone. And I looked at him, and I'm saying to myself, like, who's he talking to? I got 25 months here. I'm showing the grapevines. Like, you know, what's going on here? So what I did, I looked him dead in the eye. I said, that's okay. Okay, I'm willing to do that. I believe that tonight that I took the first three steps. Like I said, my life was unmanageable. I wanted to eat my gum. If I'm powerless, there had to be a power greater than myself. There had to be the solution. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. I didn't need to write on that for 30 days. I'm powerless. That's the problem. The solution's a power greater than myself. Step three. He told me there was a difference between making a decision and making a commitment. I got on my knees with him. We said the third step prayer. He said, okay, now let's follow it up. And I did my inventory. Now, I didn't want to do one of these. I go to meetings and I hear you people talk about, whoa, easy does it. Keep it simple. Or my favorite, you don't want to get well too soon, do you? I said, no. I'll talk about it later. I'm a cancer survivor. No, I don't want to get well too soon. No, let me run around with this and let me get crazier than a bed bug. It's nuts. Obviously, those people haven't done an inventory because they're afraid you're going to pass them. They're like me. But people who've done an inventory will strongly encourage you to do an inventory. And that's why my sponsor said, Bobby, you need to do this. He said, this program's about change, but you know what? You need to take a look at yourself to find out what you need to change. And that's what I did. And you know what? When I did my inventory, it wasn't the big boogeyman I was afraid of. There's no secrets jumped out. Everything I wrote down, I did. No secrets at all. But okay, when it came to time to fifth step, there were some secrets. Even though I wrote them down. I called my sponsor up one day and I said, Bobby, I said, I'm going to go on a retreat. I want to do my fifth step with a priest. He said, that's okay. He said, Bobby, when you get done, come back. You do it with me. And I'm saying to myself, you know how sponsors are. I'm saying to myself, I said, look, what are you, deaf? You didn't hear what I just said. And he must have picked it up on my tone. He said, Bobby, he said, my job as a sponsor is to walk you through these steps. If I'm going to help you change, I need to know what it is that needs to be changed. And I gave him, you know, I was lying to him, you know. I because I still got this resentment towards the church. Even though I wrote it down, I haven't dealt with it. And I wasn't to be spiritually enlightened. My sole motivation for doing my fifth step with the priest, because there are some behaviors that I was embarrassed about, and I thought this guy was going to pass judgment on me, ridicule me, or even worse, break my confidence. And that's the only reason I didn't want to deal with them. I didn't do it with the priest, I did it with him. And you know what? He didn't do either of those things. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his stuff with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness that I thought that I ever had. And I'll be forever grateful that he did that. But most of all, when I got done, and I sat quietly for that hour that the book tells us. And I don't hear many people talk about that. And for those who've done, like, I can only share my experience. The screaming inside stopped. Here I was, 25 months sober, no alcohol, no chemicals, nothing in me. My head's still racing. I did this fifth step, the screaming inside stopped. I've got a lot of awards and rewards in recovery, and probably one of the greatest ones, I no longer have the urge to end my life. It was incredible. And with this, I had the ammunition for the rest of the steps, you know. Character defects, I didn't know what the hell they were. I knew when I drank I was a character, but I found out, you know, when I did my inventory, I found out that I had no character whatsoever, you know. And it was a willing step, you know, and I had some experience in this in the third step. And the seventh step, you know, it was a prayer. But my sponsor told me, he said, Bobby, you got to put legs on those prayers. I could pray all day long. God, help me be honest. Help me be honest. But if I step out to the lobby and I find your wallet and I choose to slide it in my pocket, I mean, that prayer goes out the window. And so that's the seventh step for me, you know. God will do for me what I can't do for myself. But, you know, it's a program of action. You know, a lot of times we like to lay it at the higher power's feet while I turned it over. You know, for me, I used to use that line when I was irresponsible. I turned it over. My sponsor said, Bobby, this program of action, you better do some work. Because I didn't twitch my fourth step, you know, I still had it for the rest of the steps. The eighth step, most of my eighth step was already completed. And I had to make a list of all people I had harmed. Not what they did to me. I used to be one of these guys before I did my inventory. I didn't harm anybody but myself. That should have been the tip off right there. I didn't do an inventory because I wound up that I harmed everyone I came in contact with, especially my family, my loved ones. They caught most of my hell, you know. And I had a list of everyone, not what they did to me. The ninth step said direct amends. No phone calls, no letters. No, why? Because I didn't hit you with a bat over the phone or through the mail. You know? And when I want to take those measures, I can give you any number of reasons. Oh, they live far away. You know, When I want to do phone calls and letters, it's fear. I'm afraid to face it face to face. And if I got that fear, it's something I've already addressed a few steps ago. Ninth, made direct amends. And I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step. I was in a meeting about 7-8 years ago, and I did not see this guy. I saw this guy in a meeting. I have not seen this guy since 1977. He's not on my eight-step list, not through any fear, and I think just out of sight, out of mind. I forgot about the guy, but I recognized him immediately. And what would happen, when I was in a bar one day, I got an altercation with this guy. He didn't respond, so from that point on, every time I would see this guy, I would publicly embarrass that guy to make myself look like a tough guy. I'm not a tough guy, never was. Mickey could testify to that. But I would embarrass this guy. I would slap him, you know. I'd spit on him, because I knew that he wasn't going to do anything. I mean, what worse can you do to a human being than spit on him? But I knew this guy wasn't going to do nothing. So I recognized this guy. He came down the steps, and I'm sitting at the table, and I'm excited that I see him. But I'm also a little bit scared. So it's my turn, you know, I'm speaking, so I tell my story. And I stand up, and I say, my name is Bobby Coyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, I need to let you tell this real quick on this anonymity stuff. You know, I choose to use my full name, and that's a personal decision, because I believe that I understand the 11th tradition. The 11th tradition is real clear. To the level of press, radio, and films. I'm not on the radio, I'm not on television, I'm not in the newspaper saying, my name is Bobby Coyle, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is not a secret society. In fact, Dr. Bob said when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that is a violation of the 11th tradition. He said secrecy is spirit-inspired, anonymity is spiritually inspired. All of a sudden, we become like the mafia. And we're all in the witness protection program. No one wants to give up their name. You know, all of a sudden, there's Frank the Fox. There's Jimmy the Coat. There's Bucktooth Mary, Pepsi George. You know, everybody in my neighborhood knew I was a drunk. It was those little telltale signs. They'd come out, and they would catch me urinating on their car. Yeah. I'd be getting my clothes thrown out my second floor window. Everyone knew I was a drunk. All of a sudden, I get sober. I don't want to go there. But I have no right. That's just a personal decision. You know, I mean, God forbid you want to drink and you want to look up Jimmy the Coat's phone number, call information. Hey, you got Jimmy the Coat's phone number? Or God forbid you want to go visit one of them old timers in a hospital. Yeah, I'm here to visit Frank the Fox. If they got a psych ward, you know what? They admit you. You know? It's not a secret society. But that's a personal decision for me, and I have no right at all to break anybody else's anonymity. So that's that. So I looked this guy dead in the eye and said, my name is Bobby Coyle, I'm an alcoholic. And I could tell at first he didn't recognize me, but as soon as he heard my name, he nodded. So when I got done sharing my story, I then turned to the group and told the group what I used to do to this guy. His name was Bob. And I said, I'd like to take this moment to publicly apologize to Bob. And I didn't do the grandstand. I figured if I humiliate him publicly, that's the least I could do. And you know what? After the meeting, he came up and he hugged me, and it was a credible experience. And we started talking. And I said, Bob, how long are you sober? He said, I'm sober 3 years. And he's living in Roxborough, which is like northwest section of Philly. And you know, here I am, I'm in South Philly, and the meeting's in North Philly. Now, there are 1,600 meetings a week in Philadelphia. And I start talking to him. I said, what made you come here? He said, Bobby, he says, I was looking through the meeting list. I wanted to go to a different meeting, and for some reason, this meeting jumped out at me. I believe that God put that guy in my path that night to make amends. Because it says, wherever possible. Not whenever. Whenever denotes time. And you know, for us, it's never the right time. God, you know. And the feeling when he embraced me, when he hugged me, it was incredible. You know, it was an incredible feeling. You know, they're the type of men, like if I robbed you, it's real easy for me to reach in my pocket and go on a payment plan with you. But what about the emotional damage or the psychological damage, especially inflicted on my family? How do I repair that? Sometimes the best of men is after having a conversation with them is not to exhibit that behavior again. And that's what I told Bob. I apologize. And because making amends is much more than saying I'm sorry. It's about righting the wrong. And it's a lot more, because for me, I'm sorry, two words that don't mean squat. I need to follow it up with action. And on the flip side of that, ninth step. I was in my home group at one time, was the Stepping Stones group in Philadelphia, and I was their inner group rep, and I was at a business meeting one day, and I'm making a motion, and it gets seconded, but my friend Freddie leads the opposition. And my emotion goes down in flames. And I was so mad that Freddie did that to me. I said, we were boys. And I couldn't believe he did that to me. I would never talk to Freddie again. I would come to meetings, and there'd be four guys sitting there. I would say hi to three of them, and I would never talk to Freddie. I remember one day I'm at my job, and one of my coworkers came in to me, and he was in the program. He said, Bobby, Freddie Wheels is outside, and he wants to take care of some sort of business.
I says, we can't do that here. So I'm going to take a side ass down to City Hall. Let him do it down there. And I peeked out the window. I saw him sitting in his car and he drove away. 2 weeks later, that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. Now, here was a friend of mine, a real good friend of mine, and because in my head that I thought that he had a personal vendetta, he didn't like my motion, and to be honest, I didn't even forget what the motion was, but that's how petty it was. And Freddie was put my path many, many times, and I had the opportunity to make amends to him, and I chose not to. So when my coworker says he always spoke so highly of you, I thought about yay big. And I've been praying for Freddie every day since then. So that's experience with my step. You know, I had an opportunity. I took advantage of it. I reaped the rewards. I had an opportunity. I chose not to numerous times, and I'm the one who paid the price for it. You know, there's a lot of rewards in the program, and I don't think it's surprising that some of them happen at the end of the ninth step. For those who are new, and you hear people say, hey, he doesn't promise anything, man, that's a lie. The promises may not be, you know, material things, but they're intangibles. You can't put a price on peace of mind, real friendship, you know, serenity, you know, and truly know how to handle situations used to baffle us, the freedom of economic insecurity, things like that. It's amazing. But you know what? It's a program of action. Just like if you go to school, you don't make the dean's list unless you do the work. You play ball, you don't get selected for the all-star team unless you do the work. You know, you got a job, you don't become employee of the month or get those bonuses unless you do the work. Same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't get the rewards unless you do the work. It has nothing to do with time, you know? A program of action, you know? And that's what it says, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize. Well, sometimes quickly, because sometimes people get involved in the program quickly, and sometimes people get involved slowly, like I did, you know? My experience, the pain wasn't in doing the steps, the pain was in the resistance to the steps, you know? The 10th step for me is practice of 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I'm going to stand up here and tell you I do a 10th step every day, I'd be lying to you. But you'll know when I'm not doing the 10th step. People around me know, because I get to be a nitwit again, you know, and I don't like feeling that way. You know, because like I said earlier, like I was never on the beam. I've now been on the beam, and I like it. And when I get knocked off my square, I know what I got to do to get back on my square, you know. Not only do I benefit, but my family, my coworkers, everyone around me benefits when I do the right thing. And to be honest, I like doing the right thing today. And I got that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had the courage to do the right thing. I got that through walking with men, getting involved in steps, and embracing the spiritual way of life. The 11th step, you know, I dealt with that resentment, you know. I realized it wasn't the Catholic Church's fault, you know. My mom was just a sick woman, you know. And I, you know, even though I may not, you know, just put it this way, I no longer blame the church. I don't bash the church. And sometimes I get uncomfortable when I hear people do so. The church wasn't my problem. Just like I found out the Air Force wasn't my problem, the police department wasn't my problem, growing up in my neighborhood wasn't my problem, you know, I was the problem, Bobby Coyle, and I found that out through the steps. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you do the steps, you get, that's the result, you get a spiritual awakening, whether you want one or not, you know, yeah. Guarantee, the result. We tried to carry this message, that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The message is not, just don't drink and go to a meeting. That's the message, the first part of the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result. If I'm 12-stepping somebody and don't talk about the spiritual aspect of the program, I'm lying to them. I'm claiming credit for something that's beyond my control. Left my own devices, I'm a liar, thief, and a cheat. I'll use your credit card, I'll hit you with a bat, I'll spit on you, I'll curse you. That's what I do, you know? And all of a sudden I want to claim something credit, you know? I'm a drunk, that's what I am. Left my own devices, I use and abuse people. If I'm going to 12-step people and don't talk about the spiritual part of the program, that, you know, you'll hear people say, oh, don't talk about God, the newcomer, because you're going to scare them. Well, you know what? Maybe they're lucky enough to get chased right back in here because there's nowhere else for us to go. You know? Now, I don't have to beat them over the head with it. If they're not interested, that's fine. Because my sponsor keeps telling me, you know, try. I sometimes forget that word's in there. Try to carry the message. And the most important part of that 12-step, practice these principles with all my fears. I mean, I can sit up here and quote the literature and sound like the second coming of Bill Wilson. But you know what? If I go home, if I drive him back to Philly, and you cut me out, and I chase you for 5 miles, and I give you the finger, that wouldn't be practicing these principles in all my affairs. Yeah? I don't have to run around and tell people I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you a quick story. My bartender lived right across the street from me. Had a bar down the street from me, Olaf. It was a dive, it was a toilet. In fact, if you ever said, where's the toilet? I said, you're standing in it. So Joe flagged me. Now, he knew my family for years. I grew up right across the street from him. flagged me. He even knew what I did for a living. He said, Bobby, I don't care what you do. You're not allowed to come in my... And if you come in here, I'm going to, you know, beat you up. But he used a little more colorful language. I said, okay, Joe. Just got another bar, no big deal to me. And it was funny because a few years ago, Joe called me up. You know, he called my dad to get my phone number. He called me up. He said, Bob, you still go to MAA meetings? I said, yeah, Joe, I do. So I was wondering if you could help me. He said, my nephew, 17 years old, just got out of treatment. And Joe, the nephew, his parents died when he was a kid, so Joe raised his nephew. He said, I was wondering if you could take him to a meeting. This is the same guy that years ago I wasn't allowed in the toilet of a bar. And now he's trusting me to take his nephew to an AA meeting. And Joe didn't know, you know, he must have known because, you know, in my neighborhood, bad news travels quickly, you know. No one wants to talk about so-and-so got promoted. Mickey and I were talking about that earlier tonight. You know, no one wants to talk about the good news, but if I was drinking, he would have heard about it. But he knew I was doing the right thing. And here he trusted me as a family member. And that's a reward of the program. A reward of the program. You know, and that's what we're supposed to do. The preamble says, our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help the other alcoholic. It just doesn't say stay sober. It stays sober and to help. It doesn't say or. Stay sober and to help the other alcoholic who still suffers. That's our job. That's my responsibility. You know? And our statement of responsibility, when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of the AA to always be there. And for that, I'm responsible. We always want the other guy to do it, you know. I hear a lot of people say, I'm grateful, you know. I was taught that gratitude was an action word. You know, I hear all these people grateful, and I've been to meetings, and you know what? No one showed up. They didn't have a key. You know, but they're grateful, you know. And I was taught, you know, I finally got involved in service, giving it away, and that's where my sobriety really took off. The 12 steps enabled the obsession. It took the obsession to drink away from me. Then I started getting involved in service and got involved in the traditions. And as you imagine, in early recovery, I said, man, what the hell is steps? I certainly didn't want nothing to do with the traditions. And I later got introduced to the concepts. And that was a whole new deal. That was cool. I love that stuff. I got involved in service, eventually becoming the alternate area delegate for Area 59. And my goal was I was going to be the youngest delegate from Area 59 to the General Service Conference in 1993. I got elected in November, and shortly afterwards I got diagnosed with cancer. And it was a pretty fluke way the way I found out, but I went to go get a second opinion and got confirmed. And I was driving home that day, and the very first thought that popped in my head said, Bobby, you can smoke reefer because people in chemotherapy smoke pot. It was the very first thought to pop in my head. But I didn't smoke, and I'm glad I didn't, because you know what? By this point, I've been to thousands of meetings, and I've seen some people go through some terrible things for no fault of their own, and they got through without picking up a drink. And that's what AA promises you also. 24 hours of the day, you go through anything without picking up a drink. But I don't want you to think I handled this well, because I didn't. Because, you know, in the pity pot, you know, I'm doing the right thing. I'm sober for a while. Like, how did this happen to me? Ego, it's amazing. So, you know, I go through, you know, I finally left my job sick, and I finally go through treatment. I had chemo, I had radiation, and eventually I wound up having the lower left lobe of my lung removed. And I never smoked. I never smoked cigarettes. And it's amazing. I wound up with lung cancer. And I got real sick, and I was confined in my home for a bit. And I eventually had to give my position up with the area. And that hurt me, again, ego, but I knew that the area would be better served. I just did not have the commitment, you know. And it's a lot more, it's more than a title. You know, when I hear people say, you know, that, you know, that service, it's all about politics, I know that someone's never been involved in service. Because in my experience, those involved in that area of service are one of the most selfless people that I've ever met, you know. There are many nights that I would love to stay home and watch the Flyers or the Sixers or something like that. But you know what, I had a committee meeting, or I had a district meeting to go to. Because I had a responsibility to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. See, the alcoholic doesn't know that I live at 929 Federal Street. That's why I make a minimum 5 meetings a week. You know, that's where I find a newcomer, you know. I remember, you know, making a comment before. I said, yeah, you know, it was my 10th anniversary, and I threw out a little thing. I said, yeah, I said, I only need 3 or 4 meetings a week. And some old guy came up to me afterwards. He said, man, he said, you still don't get it, you selfish SOB, do you? He said, you're no longer here for yourself. You're here for the new person. And he was right, you know. And I'm glad that he spoke to me that way, because that's the type of guy that I am. I need to get hit right between the eyes. You know what? It's a responsibility. So, I get cancer, I get very sick, I can't make meetings anymore, and people start coming to my house as I get out of hospital. Now you're looking at a liar, thief, and a cheat, and people start coming to my house. People I really didn't even know that well, I just knew in passing. And, you know, I'm always amazed when I think about that, you know, the love in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been a taker my entire life. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people come to my house to carry meetings. And I wound up getting, I went in remission for a bit, and I wound up getting sick again a couple years ago. And I thought I may have had I had an excuse to go out and get loaded. But I really didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. I got a pretty good life today. I'll tell you one thing it does, when you get news like this, it gets you in gear to finish that ninth step. That's one thing that helped me. But you know what, it kind of put things in perspective. And I'm just amazed by the, I know my doctors did a pretty good job, but I in personal experience, the prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me a lot. Now, I don't want you to think I'm the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I invite you, come live with me for a week. I'm sure I'm a difficult guy to get along with. But you know what? I know I'm not intentionally harming people today. I'm not whacking guys with bats. I'm not using other people's credit cards. I'm not doing it. I'm not 13 stepping people. I'm trying to do the right thing. And I do that on a daily basis. And sometimes I stumble. And I don't want to use that excuse, well, I'm human, we claim spiritual progress, not perfection, because that's a cop-out. Most days I try to do the right thing. I can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety. I've been on some good loads, 3 or 4 day loads, and sooner or later you sobered up. You needed to drink again to stay loaded. It was the same thing about sobriety. You can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety. I've been sober since 5:45 this morning. And the chances are, if I do the same thing today that I did yesterday, chances are I won't pick up a drink. And if I'm lucky enough to get up tomorrow, I need to start the battle all over again. I was in Mexico about 8 years ago, and I thought I could speak Spanish. I was the only English speaking person in the room. Those poor people probably still figuring out what the hell I said. And then as I realized I was speaking, I realized I was in solo. I said, I better switch back to English. And I switched to English, and they still don't know what the hell I said. But after the meeting, they came up and hugged me. And you know what? I could tell who the old-timer was by the surrender in their face, and I could tell who the newcomer was by the pain in their face. Language of the heart. Incredible experience, If you're new and you think, oh, gosh, I can make these meetings, this is my sentence, my penance, you're greatly mistaken. One of my favorite sayings in the Big Book is we absolutely insist on enjoying life. If newcomers can see no joy in our existence, they won't want nothing to do with us. And I know that last line I paraphrase, but that's what it says. It's a wonderful way of life. Everything you did drunk, you could do sober. And you'd be better at it. Most of all, you can remember it. Which brings me a story about a mummer. Now, I know Mickey from Philly. I don't know many of the other people know what a mummer is, but a mummer is a New Year's Day we do in Philadelphia. Now, it's taken from Mummers, who was the Greek god of ridicule. And it's on January 1st, and there's about 30,000 of us, and it's the longest continuous parade in the country. It goes about 12, 13 hours. And what it is, it's men in sequins, feathers, and we dance in the middle of the street. Now, I've done a fifth step, so I can tell you this. So what it's something like the Mardi Gras. You've seen the Mardi Gras or Carnival. Well, we do that on New Year's Day. But it's a drunk fest. And I got sober. I could no longer strut in the parade. And 11 years ago, I'm in a meeting, and I'm telling my story. I'm a lifelong mummer. And I said, I haven't marched in the parade. You can't watch. And the kid came up to me afterwards. He said, would you be interested in the march in the parade this year? And I feel like slapping. I said, what are you, deaf? Did you hear what I said? I said, no, I can't do that. It's one of my people placing things. He said, we got a group called the 12 Steppers. We're going up the street this year. Everyone's in the program. And that's what I did. And for the last 10 years, I've marched back in the parade. In fact, this past New Year's Day, I marched in my 32nd Mummers Parade. Something like a family tradition for me, but here I get to do it sober. And not only that, this past year, the 12 Steppers, we've always been in the top 10, one of the top brigades on the street. This year, we came in first place. First time ever that I got first place in 32 parades. Now, sober mummer, that's an oxymoron. But it's a fantastic experience. And I'm thinking, wow, Christ, like if you can do a New Year sober, you can do anything. It's a wonderful way of life. It really is. If you're new, please, the principles, the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. Get a home group. Get a sponsor. Get involved in the steps. Get involved in the traditions. I love the traditions. The traditions of the group, what the steps are to the individual. A lot of people want to avoid the traditions. If there's no groups, there's no meetings, how the hell are we going to get sober? It's important. It's the whole ball of wax. It's just not the one thing. I know some people just got involved in the, religious, not spiritual, and they wound up getting drunk. I know a lot of guys that just made a lot of meetings, and they got drunk. It's just not making meetings. It's the whole ball of wax. But get a sponsor. Get a home group. Get involved in service. It's a wonderful way of life. And if you're new, please, please keep coming back. And I'll finish with this. When I started off, I said, I always wanted to be a part of, to the point where I lied. Another quick story, and I promise I'm done. I used to go to, I'm Irish. Irish is Paddy's pig. So I used to go to this bar. I found out the bartender was Ukrainian. I went in there one day. I forget, I was drinking. I don't know why I told the story. But I said, you know what, John? My mother's Ukrainian. And I used to come in the bar. He said, Bobby the Yuki. And he'd come in, he would give me shots. I lied about everything. I lied about my age, and my ethnic background. I told wonderful stories. I no longer need to lie. You know, you guys have embraced me, warts and all, you know. And I'd like to thank you for putting up for my crap over these past few years, you know. It's a wonderful way of life. And I know my family loves to thank you also, you know. This is the place I finally found part of. You know, I feel part of it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, I'd really like to thank the committee for the privilege to participate in an AA meeting. And that's all I got. Thank you.